So in your perspective, if they decide to do a paved road on that area, which has a lot of permafrost, is the state looking at...
Oh, there's no more permafrost there. The bad part of permafrost, Marie, is what I call marginal permafrost. That's permafrost at 32 degrees. Can freeze or thaw with the slightest wink of the eye. Up there in most of those areas up there, your mean temperature for the year is, you know, well below freezing. It's 28, 29 degrees, something like that. So you don't have the problems that you do, say, on the Richardson or some of those other highways where you've got 32 degree permafrost. But yeah, permafrost is our enemy, and we fight it as best we can. But and in case you didn't know it, nature always wins.
Partly, I'm asking because when you go to BLM or the visitor center, they've warned the tourist with the regular car all the hazards on this road.
It's because there's so many lawyers. They've got to put out warnings, or somebody goes up there and does something stupid and sues the BLM. The lawyers will prove it was the BLM's fault. It's like the woman that drank scalding coffee in McDonald's. You know, it wasn't her fault; it was McDonald's fault. And that's the same type of thing we're looking at here. Is everybody now is concerned about a lawsuit?
Okay. So when you look back at the construction of this road, how does it compare to other highways that you can say?
Construction in what manner? It's just no different than anything else. For instance, the Chena Hot Springs Road outside of Fairbanks looked exactly the same as the Hall Road. That also was constructed to a 28-foot top. But somewhere along the way, somebody put some pavement on it.
So that started out as a secondary
road? Well, it still is a secondary road, but there's enough traffic there, so they put pavement on it. But no, the whole road is nothing unique about it. It's just a standard old road construction, and well done, I might add.
When you look back at some of the people involved, you brought some names up earlier. But who would, when you're kind of looking at the design and the people involved with the project, what are some of the acknowledgments you would want to?
Well, the people that I worked with, I told you that Phil Holdsworth and Chuck Herbert got the whole thing started by selecting the North Slopes land and checkerboarding the initial bids. Okay. Jim Rooney and Ralph Malachi did a lot of the very basic location there.
The pipeline.
They were not. Jim Rooney's company, when Jim started this, when he and Malachi did this for Trans-Alaska, R&M didn't exist at that point. They did this as two individuals, and in the process they informed R&M, and then Malachi went off and did his own thing and died fairly soon thereafter. And Jim and his R&M company here, when things progressed in 1974, R&M was involved in some other design work. But there was him, and on the Alyeska side, we had the Michael Baker people, and the primary person that I dealt with was Nate Bauer. And Nate was the guy in charge of the road for Alyeska. And Nate, by the way, is still alive in Texas. And in fact, I got a Christmas card from him the other day. And the other guy that was very much involved was a guy named Ben Anderson, and Ben died about a year ago. He was the guy that was the hands-on guy, so to speak, on the road and pipeline construction for Alyeska. As I explained the difference between a commissioner and a deputy commissioner the other day, or an assistant commissioner, where the hands-on guy is there every day and the other person is kind of doing the public relations bit. The same was true with Alyeska when the pipeline was constructed. You had Frank Moulin, who was doing the upfront stuff, and you had Ben Anderson, who was the guy that actually had his hands on. His son is still here in town, Dwayne.
Let's take it on the day in the life of the actual construction. Did you ever go on site to see what was going on? And do you remember any like stories of camaraderie or collaboration? Just some things that stand out. Remove the technical and give me some of the humanitarian perspective that you...
The sad part of that is most of the people... See, I was extremely young when this was happening. I was going to cabinet meetings before I was 30 years old.
Jeez.
So, a lot of the contemporaries in there were guys that were 10 and 15 years older than I am, and they've all died off now. So the people that were out, a lot of the people that are out there with hands-on are now gone. In fact, I can't think of very many that were out in the midst of it, because, you know, that was 30 some years ago. And if they were 40s, 50s then, they're getting up there in the tail end of things. But no, I was too busy to be really too much involved with humanitarian things. I was involved in getting the contracts put together, the road contract, the ditch contract, approving plans, things like that, and dealing with the public relations and the fun-loving public and the fun-loving environmentalists. It was just a busy, busy time. And I would like to tell you there was a lot of jokes and whatnot, but it was pretty serious business. And there really wasn't much time for horseplay or those kinds of things. Yes, I was on the side. I took Governor Egan up, and you've got a whole bunch of photographs here of Egan and the trip we took him on. A few of those things, but not really. I don't recall anything that was... an antidote. It was just hard work. I mean, we were busy, and the staff I had and the people I had had their head up and their rear end down, and they were going.